Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, Catholic-Jewish relations under the spotlight as Pope Benedict meets with Britain's chief rabbi, Lord Jonathan Sacks. And New Zealand's bishops come to Rome for their ad limina visits. We hear from Archbishop John Dew of Wellington about the six dioceses that make up the North and South Islands. Catholic-Jewish relations were on Pope Benedict's agenda earlier this week as he met with Lord Jonathan Sacks, chief rabbi of the United Hebrew Congregation of the Commonwealth, the largest synagogue body based in the United Kingdom. As I discovered after their audience on Monday, the Pope and the rabbi discussed interfaith relations and their common concern for the decline of spiritual values in European culture. Later in the evening, Rabbi Sacks gave a lecture at the Pontifical Gregorian University, posing the question, has Europe lost its soul? An encounter chaired by the president of the Pontifical Council for Religious Relations with Jews, Cardinal Kurt Koch. The rabbi's audience with Pope Benedict was their second encounter following an interfaith meeting during Pope Benedict's visit to Britain last September. Following the audience, Rabbi Sacks came to Vatican Radio to tell me more about that and about his concern for the erosion of Europe's Judeo-Christian heritage. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, thank you very much for joining us here in studio today. I'd like to ask you, first of all, a bit about your conversation with Pope Benedict, if I can. Mm. This was your second meeting, wasn't it, really, following on from your encounter at that interfaith meeting in Twickenham last September.
I had been asked to welcome him on behalf of the non-Christian faiths in Britain. And it was actually a very moving encounter. I think we felt that something had happened at that moment. And it was, you know, a sharing of faith across the boundaries. And it was very moving. And the Pope at the time told me he wanted to deepen that relationship. So I felt this visit was a way of moving that a step further.
So can you tell us anything about your conversation this morning? What issues you discussed?
We are very concerned, obviously, with the soul of Europe. I mean, Europe was built on Judeo-Christian foundations. Even the market was built on Judeo-Christian foundations. Scholars are fascinated as to how it was that China, that had been way in advance of the West until the 15th century, had invented things long before the West did, failed to develop a market economy or a democratic society or an industrial revolution. And most scholars take the view that the difference between the West and China was that Judeo-Christian heritage.
There is great concern amongst many religious leaders about this rise of the consumer culture, this erosion of our Judeo-Christian heritage. Do you see this as a passing phase, or do you think that people of faith are having increasingly to fight for their right to be part of the national conversation?
In the Jewish community, we do not feel marginalized. We find more and more people coming to synagogue. We find more and more parents wanting to send their children to Jewish schools. And the impression is growing that there is something lacking in the wider secular culture, when all that matters is what I earn, what I spend, what I buy, what I own, instead of what I am. And I think parents are beginning to say, we don't want that for our children. We want our children to learn about a much older and more spacious heritage.
You've spoken and you've written quite a lot, haven't you, about the connections between this loss of spiritual values and the current economic crisis. You say it's no coincidence, in fact, that in Britain, shopping on Sundays and the deregulation of the financial markets occurred at about the same time. And yet it seems that despite these connections, government and financial leaders seem increasingly unwilling to take seriously, to really take into consideration the voice of faith leaders.
I think faith in the modern world, and I wouldn't have it any other way, has no power at all, but it does have a great deal of influence. Now, politics is about power. So politicians and religious leaders inhabit different universes, although many politicians have strong religious faith. But it is difficult to know exactly how do you create a partnership between the two, which is one reason I came to see the Pope, because I think if Jewish and Christian voices are heard along parallel lines, then they should not underestimate the influence they have. And of course, that was very clear in terms of the visit of the Pope to Britain just over a year ago. Everyone was amazed that the interest was so acute and so widespread. And everyone saw a gentle, very spiritual, very holy person. And that had huge impact. So, yes, it is true that religion doesn't play a part in the political arena, but I'm glad about that. We should not aspire to political power. But we are talking to people, especially when they're thinking, what kind of answer do I want to give to the meaning of life, and what kind of value system do I want for my children?
Were you able to talk much this morning about interfaith relations, about the Jewish-Christian relationship?
Well, the Pope himself raised it and continually wanted to know how was that state of relationship in Britain, where, in fact, of course, it's as good as you will find anywhere in the world. He also wanted to know, just to reaffirm his belief in our shared belief in the God of Abraham, our shared commitment to the Ten Commandments, and our shared belief that society must have a spiritual dimension.
You've written a lot about interfaith relations, haven't you? Notably in your book, The Dignity of Difference. And yet, in trying to reach out to other faiths, you've been accused of betraying your traditional Orthodox Jewish teachings. What do you say to your accusers about the truth to be found in other religions?
Well, what is absolutely clear from the Bible is that you have some very godly individuals who are not part of the Abrahamic covenant. Famously, you have Malki Tzedek, the contemporary of Abraham, who is called by the Bible the priest of the Most High God. You have Moses' father-in-law, Jethro, a Midianite priest. And my favorite of all, which is Pharaoh's daughter, who, at great risk to herself, saves the young Moses. Without a Pharaoh's daughter, there wouldn't be a Moses. So the Bible is not partisan at all in the way it sees righteousness and godliness. It sees it in all sorts of places.
On the subject of Jewish attitudes towards the Catholic Church, there seems to be quite a lot of divisions, not perhaps just in Britain, but in other countries too, with some applauding Pope Benedict and John Paul before him for really helping to implement the spirit of Nostra Aetate, and others seeming to see the Catholic Church really only in terms of the perceived failure to apologise for not speaking out more strongly during the Holocaust. How do you think we can move beyond these divisions?
My view is axiomatic and fundamental. The God of love and forgiveness created humanity in love and forgiveness and asks of us to love and forgive others. And that is the attitude I bring to Jewish-Christian relations. And I hope it's the attitude Christians bring to that same relationship. We recognize the extraordinary about turn that occurred in the Catholic Church at really the inspiration and depth of compassion of Pope John the 23rd, which set in motion the process that culminated in Vatican II, the result of which is that Jews and Catholics, having been estranged for many centuries, now meet again today as cherished and respected friends. You would find it hard to find a transition like that in the whole of European history. So I see the hope vastly outweighing the anxieties, and the good news vastly exceeding the bad.
Do you see divisions between liberal and orthodox trends, reformists and traditionalists, if you like, in Judaism, as well as, of course, we have within the Catholic Church? Sometimes this seems to be as damaging as the tensions between the different faiths. Is this an increasing, are you concerned about an increasing polarization within the Jewish world along these lines?
No, in Britain we have actually solved the problem, and we had to solve the problem because we cannot make peace with the world if we can't make peace among ourselves. And when relationships got a little tense some 15 years ago, I sat down and said to myself, we have to develop fundamental principles of a relationship that has integrity. In the end, I formulated two principles, and they work. number one, on all matters that affect us as Jews, regardless of our religious denomination. We will work together, regardless of our religious denomination. On all matters that touch on our differences, we will agree to differ, but with respect. The result of which is that Orthodox and non-Orthodox Jews in Britain are closer together today than they were at any other time. Of course, a famous Jew, Abba Iban, once said, we're the people who can't take yes for an answer. So there are some people who have not quite caught up with reality. But the fact is, for the first time in history, I, as an Orthodox chief rabbi, sit together with Reform and Liberal rabbis as joint presidents of the Council of Christians and Jews. And on interfaith matters, as on all matters that touch on our common fate, we work together.
Looking at the document Nostra Aetate, of course, well known for its condemnation of anti-Semitism in any form, do you see, are you concerned about a rise of anti-Semitism in Europe today?
I am mortified by the return of anti-Semitism to Europe within living memory of the Holocaust. We had believed never again, but it has returned. It is extremely worrying and disturbing, and as I said very candidly at a European conference convened by Romano Prodi already 8 years ago in the European Centre in Brussels, I said Jews cannot fight anti-Semitism alone. The victim cannot cure the crime. The hated cannot cure the hate. I will fight for the right of Christians anywhere in the world to live their faith without fear, but I need them to fight for my right, the right of my people to live their faith without fear. The result is that in Britain, we have become perhaps the first country where the fight against anti-Semitism is led by non-Jews. And that is very, very moving and very significant.
So it's a coalition, you're saying, of people across the spectrum
in
Britain?
It is a coalition of parliamentarians led by the Prime Minister. Tony Blair, Gordon Brown, David Cameron have all got up in public and said quite simply in these words, I promise that Jews will never have to fight anti-Semitism alone. They've accepted that responsibility, and it's very important. At the same time, I believe in the other side of the bargain as well. So on Friday, just a few days ago, I spoke in the House of Lords about my concern and my solidarity with Christians in the Middle East who are suffering persecution and great uncertainty. There's been a mass exodus of Christians from Iraq. As many as 100,000 Christians, Coptic Christians, may have left Egypt. We have the situation of Christians in Syria entirely in doubt. And it is important that Jews, the British Jewish, the European Jewish community, stand in solidarity with Christians where they face persecution.
How much do you see the Israeli-Palestinian conflict really as the problem at the root of all these other areas you mentioned around the Middle East, and also potentially as the cause of this anti-Semitism that you say is on the rise?
I refuse to accept that for one simple reason. And I tell this to my Muslim friends and I tell this to my friends of all faiths. We must be sending a message of coexistence from Europe to the Middle East. We must not allow ourselves to import a message of conflict from the Middle East to Europe. If the already difficult situation between Israelis and Palestinians is difficult enough in itself, that the whole of Europe should be made a proxy battlefield for that conflict will not bring peace, but on the contrary will devastate the outstandingly good relations that exist between the faiths in Europe.
The political situation seems to be at something of a stalemate. Are there any signs of hope for you at the moment in that conflict?
I have made a great distinction in all my writings between optimism and hope. And knowing history as we do, no Jew can be an optimist. But no Jew worthy of the name ever lost hope. And when it comes to peace in the Middle East between Israelis and Palestinians, I refuse to give up hope. there is still a genuine majority on both sides in favor of a two-state solution. And although the political process may have reached a momentary stalemate, as it seems to have done, nonetheless, the underlying attitudes on both sides embolden my hope to believe that a peaceful settlement is possible and will be reached.
Finally, you've said yourself that you'll be stepping down from your job in 2013, after almost a quarter of a century as the chief rabbi there. What do you see perhaps as your most significant success? What would you like to be remembered for in that job?
We tried to do three things, and I think we succeeded. First, I made a pledge that we would increase the level and depth of Jewish education. And we have seen in 20 years the percentage of Jewish children at Jewish day schools go up from around 25 to 30% to nearly 70%. So we've built more Jewish day schools in the last 20 years than at any previous time of our over 350-year history. The second was I wanted to be a catalyst for creativity. I note that the Pope calls the Catholic Church today a creative minority. Now, to be a Jew is to be a member of a creative minority, and we have seen in the last 20 years an explosion in cultural and other forms of Jewish expression, some religious, some not, but all vivid, vital, and full of energy, and we have a much more energetic community than we had before. And finally, I took it on myself as far as I could, just by sort of doing it, to allow the Jewish voice to be heard in the public square. I believe that Jews should not simply keep to themselves. We should seek to be a voice in the conversation of humankind. In fact, I define Judaism as the voice of hope in the conversation of humankind. And the British public have been quite extraordinarily warm in welcoming that sharing of Jewish wisdom. And I believe we are all enriched when the great faiths share their wisdom with those of any faith and those of none.
Lord Jonathan Sacks, thank you very much
thank
for sharing
you.
Your wisdom with us today.
Thank you.
My thanks there to Lord Jonathan Sacks, Chief Rabbi of the United Hebrew Congregation of the Commonwealth. New Zealand's seven Catholic bishops are in Rome this week for their Ad Limina visit, which began on Monday. The bishops are visiting the different pontifical councils and congregations ahead of a meeting with Pope Benedict to report on concerns and challenges for the church in their country. Among the issues they'll be discussing is the cause for beatification of Mother Suzanne Ober, who founded the Daughters of Our Lady of Compassion, New Zealand's only surviving indigenous congregation. Before making the long journey back home, the bishops will also have time to meet with New Zealand priests, religious and lay people who are studying or working here in Rome. To find out more about the church in the six dioceses that make up the North and South Islands of New Zealand, Emma McCarthy spoke with the president of the bishops' conference, Archbishop John Dew of Wellington.
New Zealand is a small country. It's only a population of just 4.4 million. And the church is, Catholics are about 15% of the total population. But at the same time, even though we're small, we're quite visible, especially, I think, through the Catholic school system. We have 65,000 pupils in our Catholic schools, and our school system is recognized as being vital in providing very good education. Catholics are prominent in civic life, in national and local body politics, and in various professions. The country is marked by a growing ethnic diversity. There have always been waves of immigrants coming to New Zealand, sort of straight after the war, or for many years, actually, English, Irish, Italian, Dutch, and then after the Second World War, big waves of people from the Pacific Islands, from Samoa, Cook Islands, Tonga, and some of the smaller island nations. And then in recent years, a lot more immigrants from Asian countries, certainly Filipinos, Korean, African countries, and Middle Eastern countries. So all of those people, there are smaller numbers of them in our parishes, in our diocese, but they are making a significant impact on the life of the church. Main challenges, I suppose, how to be present for us in a growing secularized society. It's often spoken of that we are a very secular country, so that is a challenge. We have a national bioethics centre, and that's engaged in a lot of issues around consistent ethic of life. We've just recently set up a national Catholic tertiary institution called the Catholic Institute of Aotearoa New Zealand. And the point of that is so that we can coordinate our teaching staff. There are only six dioceses, so to coordinate our teaching staff, but also to be a centre for research and to speak out on issues of morality and politics, and to be present sort of in the medical field and with politicians and decision makers. Staffing of parishes continues to be a big challenge for us because of the dwindling number of active clergy with an aging clergy. We are beginning to get some vocations from some of the Asian immigrants who have come here. But that continues to be a challenge. And I suppose just the integrating or the whole process of enculturating and welcoming those people into our parishes.
In fact, one of the themes of the Synod for Oceania was enculturation. What progress has been made in this field?
I think we have made some good progress. There's always been a big dialogue with the Maori population, the indigenous population. Of course, the first missionaries came here to serve the Maori people. And our new missal is published in, not completely in Maori, but there's a lot of the Maori language throughout the new missal, which bishops were committed to because we believed it was a very good signal of our bicultural relationship with the Maori. So enculturation and liturgy, also in theology and spirituality, the Maori have values which are the Maori words, mana, tika, and pono, which I guess we describe as the dignity and the value of the human person. For example, recently at a big seminar on euthanasia, the Maori just said, but how could you even think of that? You know, there's this great deep respect. So that's one of their values that we're trying to instill in society. The other area of enculturation is the integration of those other ethnic minority groups which have recently arrived in New Zealand. We keep looking for ways that value and enhance the gift of religious and cultural values that they bring. And in actual fact, I had a meeting just last Sunday with 9 different ethnic groups, and it was very enriching. And, you know, trying to say to them, as part of our parishes and part of our diocese, we want to welcome you, want you to be using those gifts and enriching our parish and diocesan communities. And then I suppose a third area of enculturation is just that ongoing dialogue with secular society. How do we speak the gospel there? How do we make gospel values known? And just trying to influence society by speaking openly of gospel values through sort of story and metaphor. Often the religious language doesn't immediately impact on people once you tell the stories and the values behind it. So there's some of the things. I think we're probably fairly proud, I suppose, of some of the ways that the Pacific Islanders have been integrated. Well, we've used their culture in many of our liturgies. There's some wonderfully powerful things. And, of course, that even happened at the Synod for Oceania. The opening and closing liturgies were very much a lot of Polynesian presence there, Samoan, Maori, which really had an impact, I think.
Next year sees the Synod for the New Evangelization call for by Pope Benedict XVI. How urgent is new evangelization in a secular society like New Zealand? And what role can be played by lay people in the local church to contribute to new evangelization?
We've seen that as a wonderful opportunity, and at our councils of priests and our diocesan pastoral councils, really said this is a wonderful opportunity for us, the whole theme of new evangelization. Our clergy are saying that the wonderful opportunities that are there at times of weddings and baptisms and funerals, where a lot of people, you know, who might be baptized but really haven't really been catechized or evangelized. We've asked lay people to pick up the theme of Pope Benedict's Year of Faith. We've looked at the linear mentor for the synod, and he talks about six areas. I know that one is politics, I think one is enculturation, and we've proposed that we might run some seminars and invite some speakers to talk on those topics, so that theme of the new evangelization comes through there.
Looking now perhaps more specifically at one of the areas you already touched on, which is young people and youth ministry, have World Youth Days had any impact in New Zealand, particularly thinking of Sydney 2008 perhaps, and have they given a boost to vocations in the country or even commitment to church life?
I think Sydney was a wonderful experience for us. We had 4,000 pilgrims went across from New Zealand to Australia, which is no mean feat for a small country like this. It was, in actual fact, it was the biggest number of young people, biggest exodus of young people since the Second World War that had ever left New Zealand. And before that, we also hosted days in the diocese. It's usually, you know, by one country, but we had permission from the Pontifical Council to host. So we had about 3,000 international pilgrims here for days in the diocese. Now, that had an enormous impact on the life of on the communities, and I think on the life of young people. I do believe that they are much more involved in the church through youth ministry. I think there's a small increase in vocations. It's hard to tell whether it's specifically because of World Youth Day, but certainly some of the young men that I've spoken to have picked up their thoughts about a vocation from being at World Youth Day.
Let's look at the ecumenical relations in New Zealand. As you said, Catholics are a minority, but Christianity, I believe, is the majority religion in New Zealand. What are your relations with the other religious communities?
The bishops, we meet on a regular basis with the Anglican bishops, and we have a meeting once a year. Some of the mainline churches, Presbyterian, Anglican, Methodist, Salvation Army, and ourselves, have set up what we call the New Zealand Council of Christian Social Services, where we look at a lot of social justice issues in the country, and that's a very good area of cooperating at the work level. Each year there's the Week of Prayer for Christian Unity, just held between the Ascension and Pentecost, and that's always well supported. Each year on Ash Wednesday, most of the Anglican and Catholic parishes have a joint Ash Wednesday distribution of the ashes. Sometimes at Christmas time, Advent time, this time of the year, there's also a joint service. There's also ongoing discussions about the whole question of Christian unity. It's difficult with some of the more Pentecostal fundamental churches, but that dialogue for Christian unity does actually continue.
Archbishop John Dew of Wellington, New Zealand there, speaking with my colleague Ema McCarthy. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow, or find us on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're listening to Vatican Radio, Laudato Jesus Christus.